The fall of Constantinople in 1453. Where are Constantine's allies? Now, last time, we were looking at the construction of the Rumali Hussar Fortress by Mehmet, and of course, talked a little bit about the Venetians. But there are other European countries that should be coming to Constantine's aid. Now, Genoa, the other big Italian trading city, was in a similar position as Venice, but it was a little more nervous. She had troubles also in Europe, and she needed ships to protect her home waters as well as her eastern colonies. The government published one or two exhortations to the peoples of Christendom to send help against the Turks, but it was not prepared to send any itself. Now, private Genoese citizens were given permission to do as they pleased. There was particular anxiety about Pisa and the Black Sea colonies. The Podesta of Pera was instructed to make whatever arrangements he thought best with the Turks in hope that even if Constantinople fell, that colony might be spared. And similar instructions were given to Mahona, the committee that governed Chios. In any event, the Turks must not be unnecessarily provoked. The Ragusians, like the Venetians, had recently had their privileges at Constantinople confirmed by the emperor, but they too traded in Ottoman ports. They were not going to risk any of their small fleet against the sultans, except perhaps as part of a greater coalition. For all his dissatisfaction with the Byzantines, Pope Nicholas was sincerely shocked by the proof of the sultan's intentions. He induced Frederick III, Holy Roman Emperor, when he came to Rome to be crowned in March of 1452, to send a stern ultimatum to Mehmet. Of course, it was simply an empty bombast. Everyone knew that Frederick neither had the power nor the desire to follow through with any action. Alfonso was even more deeply involved. He was the king of Naples, with interests and claims in Greece, and the Catalans who traded in Constantinople were his subjects. Again, he's full of promises and fulfilled them so far as to send a flotilla of 10 ships, for which the Pope paid most of the expenses, into the Aegean waters, but he withdrew it a few months later when he allied himself with the Venetians against Francesco Sforza of Milan. And they were also nervous of the Genoese reaction. Nicholas, with Bessarion at his side, vainly sought for help elsewhere. Neither his ambassadors nor Constantine's received any response to their appeals. He was now eager to do what he could for the emperor, as he had received a letter written soon after the sultan had completed building the Rumali Hussar, in which Constantine undertook to implement the union of the Orthodox Church with the Roman Catholic Church. Now, Isidore rejected Metropolitan of Kiev and all Russia, and recently created a cardinal of the Roman Empire, had been appointed papal legate to the emperor in Constantinople in May of 1452. He now left for Constantinople. He paused on the way at Naples, where he recruited, at the Pope's expense, a force of 200 archers, and at Mytilen, where he was joined by the Archbishop Leonard of Chios, a Genoese by origin. They arrived in Constantinople on October the 26th. His military escort, small though it was a token that the Pope would send practical assistance to people that recognized his authority, and the gesture was not wasted. Not only was Isidore welcomed with deference by the emperor and his court, but there was even some enthusiasm among the populace. Getting the populace of Constantinople enthusiastic is really hard. The emperor was quick to follow this up. Committees representing the people of the city and the nobles were appointed to give their adherence to this new union. The people's committee agreed, as the opponents of the union refused to sit in on it. The nobles' committee, where the discussions were more serious, would have preferred a compromise by which the pope's name would be commemorated in the liturgy, but the actual promulgation of union would be deferred. But the emperor, pushed by Isidore, overruled them. It was almost certainly Lucius Notorius who handled the negotiations, and he acted with great tact. He, of course, received no thanks for it. To Gennadius and the intransigent opponents of the union, he seemed to be deserting the cause, while Isidore and the Latins doubted his sincerity. They were so far right in that he seems to have advocated the use of economy, the doctrine dear to Orthodox theologians, which permits a condemnation explanation of divergency in the higher interests of the Christian Commonwealth. And he seems also to have hinted that the whole question could be reopened when the crisis was over. Gennadius was bitterly distressed. Before Isidore's arrival, he had delivered a passionate speech to the people, begging them not to desert the faith of their fathers in hope of material assistance that would be of little value. But the sight of the cardinal's soldiers made them waver. He therefore retired to his cell in the Pantocrator after affixing to the monastery gate an angry manifesto in which he warned the people once more of the criminal folly of their abandonment of the true religion. Lucius Notarius wrote to him to say that his opposition was vain, but his influence began to be felt again. There were anti-Latin riots in the streets of Constantinople, and as the weeks passed and no more troops arrived from the west, the enemies of the Union recovered their strength. Now, Cardinal Isidore, who himself was a Greek, behaved with forbearance and tact, so much so that the emperor's confidant, Byzantes, suggested that it might be wise to appoint him patriarch in place of the absentee Gregory Mamas. But Constantine knew that Isidore would never agree to do that. Archbishop Leonard, however, with a Latin's concept for the Greeks, was dissatisfied. He demanded that the emperor should arrest the leaders of the opposition and appoint judges to condemn them. It's a totally foolish suggestion. All that would have done is simply created martyrs. Constantine contented himself with summoning the members of the Synax to meet with him at the palace on November the 15th to explain their objections. At his request, they drew up and signed a document giving reasons for their refusal to accept the Union of Florence. They reiterated their theological disapproval of its formula on the Holy Spirit. But they would, they said, welcome another council, be held at Constantinople, and to be attended by qualified representatives of all the Eastern churches. Now, the only obstacle to this was the ill will of the Latins. They would, they added, gladly receive back the Patriarch Gregory if he would assure them he shared their faith. It is not known whether Gennadius was present at the meeting with the emperor. He was not among the 15 signatories of the document, who included 5 bishops, 3 high dignitaries from the patriarchate, and 7 abbots and monks. Their attitude was not unreasonable. If the union was not to provoke a schism between the Church of Constantinople and all other Orthodox churches, but the politicians' unity with the West, which might bring material help, took precedence over unity of the Eastern churches, which could provide no assistance. A few days later, there occurred the sinking of the Venetian merchant ship by the guns of Romali Hussar. Now a new wave of panic swept through the city. The need for Western aid seemed more urgent than ever. The Unionist Party won back supporters. Gennadius, fearing, as he admitted, that the desire for help would spread like a forest fire, issued another broadsheet to emphasize that Western help involved union. He repeated it that he at least would not allow his faith to be sullied in the hope of help, the efficiency of which was very doubtful. And then his words were read and noted. So we have this issue. Split in the church, appears to be union in the church, trying to put things together. But Western Europe is in total disarray. Orthodoxy is in total disarray. And this is a result of Crusade of 1204, when the Crusaders took over Constantinople and turned it into Latin kingdoms along with the rest of its empire. It had never recovered, and it needed to be rejuvenated with the old style religion and Byzantine background, but they didn't have any money. You know, very little territory left, and most of it not very, shall we say, financially successful for the emperor. We have all of these other people, the Venetians, the Genoese, trading with anybody, and no one really wants to come to his aid. They still, within their hearts, believe that Constantinople would still survive. Technology is advancing beyond that. So it's a disunified Western world facing Mehmet, and it did not require a genius of military tactics to take advantage of the situation. But Mehmet does understand superior firepower. Now, the sources for this: Short History of Byzantium by Norwich, The Fall of Constantinople in 1453 by Runciman, The Byzantine Art of War by Decker, Byzantine Armies 325 to 1453 by Bezos. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out the CDs. And if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.